You're listening to the Barry Egan Tapes on News Talk. I'm Barry Egan from the Sunday Independent, and I'm talking with Philly McMahon. Philly, thanks for coming in, and Merry Christmas.
Thanks.
Did writing The Choice help you grieve, help you heal the pain of losing your brother John?
Yes, it definitely did. I suppose when John passed, I was kind of thinking that working hard would help me grieve, and it was just a distraction, I suppose, in reflection. Because when somebody dies from a drug-related death, or maybe someone dies from suicide, it's classed as a special death. So it's a longer process, grieving process. And they say it takes around 4 years to actually properly grieve from a special death. So, and they actually say that it's like grieving two deaths. So there's a complete process to it. But for me, it was only when I sat around a table with my family and I spoke to John's friends, actually realised what grieving was. And it's actually kind of like a weight off your shoulders where you just express a lot of your emotions. So for me, when speaking about John and writing the book, it definitely helped me massively to grieve.
And we talk about healing. Are you healed, or can you ever be fully healed?
No, you can't. I don't think you can. I think you understand the process a little bit more. You understand life and death from your own perspective as well. So it makes you reflect a little bit deeper, but there's always that reminder of someone that just mentions a brother or somebody that, you know, there's a family member at, you know, let's say a match or something like that, and you reflect back and you go, oh, I'd love John to be here, I'd love to be at that. So I don't think you ever get rid of it, because it's that connection of love, and that's why we grieve in the first place.
And did it make you understand what love is, John not being there?
Yeah, it made me understand that I needed to have a more of a focus on my relationships in my life.
Yeah.
So it did make me deeply reflect on the way and the amount of time I was spending time with my family, like, you know. So I think it's, unfortunately, there's a lot of people in society today that will wait till something like that happens to realise, you know, I want to spend more time with my loved one, or I want to spend more good energy with my loved one rather than time, you know.
And when that happened to you, you took time to reflect and reassess your life. What did you reassess?
Well, I looked at what I was achieving in life and what standards
and what was important.
Yeah, and what I was doing. And I suppose prior to that, I was like a lot of people. I was thinking of making a lot of money and thinking of conquering the world. Well, when I've got to the stage where I realise it's okay to be not doing them things, it's okay to, and it's, I suppose that stemmed from developing a purpose when I started speaking about John in 2015. And realising that I can engage with people through my profile and through my experiences. So for me, the education around who I am and what I'm doing in life has completely changed from John's death.
It showed you how to do something positive with celebrity, in a sense, or what you do for a living.
Yeah, definitely. It's helped me use my profile as a sporting person to help others.
Yeah, because I thought it was fascinating that you've said that the reason you started kicking a ball was to get your brother's attention.
Yeah, I remember a couple of years ago, you know, going to kind of media launches and journalists saying to me, you know, who's your, what inspired you to play football and stuff like that. And I always said, you know, well, I played a little bit in primary school and Paddy Christie came along then. But then deeply reflecting, I always wanted to hang around with John, because I was the younger brother, obviously, and he was 7 years older than me, and he was hanging around with the so-called cool kids at that time. And kicking the football off the flats to get close to them was probably kind of a smart way to hang around them. But ultimately, it's the reason why I picked up the football. And his mates were brilliant, because they used to play football back with me. Like, and he had no choice then for me to hang around with him, because I was messing with the ball with his mates, you know.
And he was like your protector back then, was he?
Yeah, he was 6'4". He was very...
How tall are you?
I'm 6 foot with high heels on, and I didn't get the height GNC did, but he was well able to handle himself, you know. He was fearless, and I was the typical brother that always said, you know, I'll get me brother after you.
Yeah.
So
what was John like before heroin?
It's very hard to remember back to when he was a non-addict, because he was 7 years older than me. So you have to remember, he was 14 when he took his first hit of heroin. And I'm sure me and my family only realised he was kind of really bad in terms of addiction when it was probably maybe 16, 17, maybe 18. my mum certainly wouldn't have realised he would have took heroin that younger. That only came out when we were talking to his friend about the book. When did they? I asked the question, when was the first hit of heroin you took? And he said 14. So, John, I was 7. John was 14 when he took his first hit. So I don't actually...
Do you remember, in hindsight, looking back, was there a time you think, God, maybe that was it? Or
you? Yeah, I would have seen... I would have shared a room with John, and I would have seen Tim fall around the house at stages, you know. You see, the one obvious thing is the physical appearance. You know, you'll see them getting a little bit thinner. Obviously, you'll see them kind of goofing off, which is basically closing their eyes and nodding off. And he was smart, and a lot of addicts are. They hide that very well early on. And they get to the stage where the addiction takes so much of a toll on their body that they can't hide it anymore. It's just a part of who they are, and they actually get to the stage where they actually don't care. The most important thing is not what people think of them. It's getting that drug. They're in that much pain. So I suppose the only thing I can say is that I remember John 1 year coming back from London. Now, that might overshadow all the other times I've seen him clean, but that one for me, I'll never forget. Because he came, when he was in London, he'd come home every year. And I think he went in around 2008, 2007, 2008. And he came home maybe 2010, kind of halfway through the 4 years he was over there. And he walked through the door, and I just couldn't believe it. I was like, this is...
Because of the way he looked.
He was clean, yeah, and he was fresh. He was always one or the other. He was always thin, and you knew he was on heroin, or he was bloated from the methadone. So you would have seen in the book or the documentary, you would have seen two different types, and you'd say, Jesus, that looks like two different people there. This guy that I seen coming home 1 year for Christmas was just, it was incredible. I had such a buzz.
You had a buzz of hope for him?
A proudness of... Yeah, you can do it, you know, and I'm so happy now that I was proud to an extent, John being my brother, because I always said, I'll get my brother after you, you know, always was, that's my brother, like, you know, and obviously then the drugs and the drug addiction took a toll on my emotions around that, and then I kind of had negative output in terms of being embarrassed and being angry that he'd go that route, and that my family wasn't perfect, but seeing John that day... The only other feeling I've ever experienced it is, and it's not, it probably, it doesn't even meet it, it's actually winning an All-Ireland, you know. It's still, I was that ecstatic to see him, and that kind of hairs in your back, kind of, you know, the back of your neck sticking up, it was just incredible.
What other happy memories have you of John?
Well, John, through his addiction, worked. He was a functional addict for a long time. And every month John would have brought me into town and bought me jerseys, football jerseys. So I loved every month when John...
Was that his way of encouraging you?
Could have been, yeah, it could have been. Yeah, he was... He always wrote in his letters to me that he was proud of me and proud of what I was doing. And he always wanted to get clean to share that experience, them experiences with me, like, but... Unfortunately, we didn't get the chance.
There was a semi-final he said he was going to come back for if you'd won, and unfortunately you didn't win.
No, well, it was the final we wanted to come to. So 2011, we won the All-Ireland. It was the first time we've won it in 16 years. And he was saying, you know, sorry I couldn't get over to the final, but I'll hopefully get over to this year's final if you beat Mayo in the semi-final. And unfortunately we got beat, and then, yeah, he passed that year, look.
Yeah. How did it make you feel to read those letters when he used to write you?
I suppose it kind of, the letters at the beginning, you know, when you have a sibling that's an addict, you kind of go through a process of, you go, yeah, no, you know, like he was saying, no, I'm going to get clean, I'm going to come off, and I mean it this time. And it doesn't have to be through a letter. You'd see a lot of addicts would say it to their family members, like, no, I'm going to get clean, I'm going to do it. And you kind of lose hope. And the only person that didn't lose hope was my mum. And the rest of us, it's not so much that we lose hope, it's probably that we try to use love as a tool or a bargaining tool to try to get them off drugs. So it's called tough love. And that didn't really work, so...
Your mother just used pure love?
Yeah.
Because that's all she knew.
She never gave up on them once, you know, and a lot of mothers, I'm sure, do that. And so did my dad. But... It's only when he passed that you really look at them letters and you go, wow, they meant a lot. The last one he wrote was a birthday card. It was like a letter on the birthday card. And
Was that to you?
Yeah. So that was when he was saying he was going into rehab for methadone. So he was 5 days away from it. So that was...
So he was close to being...
Oh, yeah. He was fine. Like, he... The big thing with addicts is, right, no matter what policy we have in this country, the addict has to want to come off the drug, right? They have to hit rock bottom. No matter how many addicts I've spoken to, I've asked them over and over again the same question. How did you become clean? So when I'm talking to recovery addicts, how do you become clean? And the answer is, I hit rock bottom. There's a little spark that just ignites from something. Maybe a family member, maybe a child or a mother, just they see them going through such bad experiences that they just basically hit rock bottom. I remember chatting to a guy and I said, how did you do it? And he says, imagine fighting Mike Tyson every morning. And just one morning waking up and saying, Mike, I'm not fighting you anymore. So, you know, that's the experience that we don't understand. People that are non-addicts, we don't understand that pain and that suffering that they're going through. It's colossal, like, you know, it's...
Did you have these conversations with John?
No, I wouldn't.
Did you say, how can I help you? And
Yeah, I would have. I would have spoke to him every Christmas. Because John used to bring me into town and
at this time of year, Christmas.
Yeah. It got to an age where it flipped, where I'd give John a few bob going back on the boat to England, like, you know. I used to love that. I used to love walking out my mum's and just giving him a hug and saying, here's a few bob, look after yourself. And it was kind of that reverse flip. So, but he always said, you know what, it shouldn't be this way. He always said, I should be looking after you still. I said, no, look, we're adults now, like, you know. But I always try to speak to him as much as I could to change. And one thing, the one big learning I had was that there was times where he was slipping and he'd be talking to me mum on the phone. Like, I'd be so happy that he'd changed. And then when he started to slip again, my mum would be on the phone to him and you'd hear his voice change. And I'd be so disappointed and so angered. That there'd be times when my mum said, right, do you want to talk to John? And I'd be like, no, don't want to talk to him. So I can hear his voice that he's back messing about, like, you know.
Did that make you feel guilty after he died? Then?
If I had the education I had now, I would be guilty. Well, I didn't have the education. The country and the people of this country have been let down through education in terms of drug addiction. From the family point of view and from the individual's point of view.
How would you change everything?
There's a lot of work that's needed.
So what would you say to kids now who are contemplating taking heroin?
It's not words, it's showing them. You got to show them. That's what happened to me. A lot of my friends ended up on drugs and in prison and for them overdose and died. And it's not about the education piece of our parents saying, don't take drugs. And I'm not saying to tell our kids to take drugs, but we have the fourth highest overdose rate in Europe. That has been our message all along, from our parents' point of view, from teachers, and from our government. And it hasn't worked.
Why hasn't it worked?
Because I believe that drugs is going to be here. We're never going to get rid of it. And it's just about managing drugs. You know, there's plenty of people in all shapes and sizes and professions in this country that have taken drugs. Unfortunately, there is some of them that actually become addicts. So it's important that we realise that. Again, I think the big step and the big change is that we may be letting people down in terms of our policy. Like, our policy needs to be looked at, because our policy influence shame and stigma massively. And shame and stigma pushes addicts further and further into addiction and further away from reintegration into society.
Is that why John went to England? Was the shame and the stigma too much to grow up here?
But no, the idea was that his best friend had been clean. And he went to his dad's apartment and took a slip and died. And the family said, look, get him out of the environment. There has to be that. It's the environment. It's around him. He knows all your addicts, all your drug dealers around here. Let's get him out of there. Send him to London. And he became clean because he didn't know any other addicts or drug dealers. But unfortunately, at that stage, the drugs had taken a toll. His physical appearance had changed. He was always thin. He was 6'4". He found it hard to get a job. He found it hard to socialise with people, other people that were maybe not addicts. And he had a comfort zone. That's what addicts have when they take drugs, a comfort zone. And his comfort zone in terms of socialising was other addicts. They were the only people that would relate to him. So that's what we have now in this country. People will look very negatively upon addicts, which pushes them deeper. You'll see them all congregating in the streets. Because they're the only people that they're out. Like, ultimately, right, the fear is that addicts, they'll rob you and they'll steal, and they will. Do you know why? Because they have to feed a habit that's probably worth about €30,000 a year. And they're jobless, right? They're not functional. They get to the stage where they're homeless. Where are they going to feed the habit? It's like, if we could imagine that we go out and we work for money every day, and that gives us food, that's all they want. They don't even want food. They want that drug that bad. The dopamine release in their brain is really gone bonkers for them to take this drug. So, Barry, I could talk all day about what needs to be changed. There's a huge amount of things that need to be changed, but certainly we need to break down the stigma so that people can reintegrate back into society. We need to have a policy that basically says, when you decide you want, when you hit rock bottom and you want to come off drugs, we have a policy that will support that. And we have a policy that looks to harm reduction and makes you stay on the planet long enough to come off the drug.
You told me once that the last time you cried was at John's funeral in Darterstown. Is that still the case?
No, I would have cried at my dad's funeral, and I would have cried the All-Ireland final this year, because my dad wasn't there.
What kind of man was your father?
My dad was a proud Republican from West Belfast.
Are you a proud Republican from Ballymun?
Am I a proud Republican? I'm proud of my dad's Republicanism. Yeah. I'm not Republican. I'm proud of my dad standing for his self-beliefs and fighting for his country. I am that. And there's a lot of negative propaganda around the Troubles back then, certainly from a Republican point of view. But for me, my dad stood for his country and he fought for his country. And I can only say that now because he's no longer here. But like, it's incredible to think that my dad, at a very young age...
Came from Belfast, didn't he?
Yeah, from Belfast, was injured in the Troubles. Eventually, obviously, joined the Republican movement and moved down to Dublin and has a family and has a son that has won six All-Irelands. Yeah. So that's huge adversity to come through.
Yeah. What are your memories of your father?
He tried to give me everything he possibly could, him and my mum at a very young age. No matter what, he would have got me to football matches and we wouldn't have car transport. He would have walked me down to, let's
How
say,
far
Fairview.
Was that?
Well, he would have walked me from Ballymun to Fairview.
And walk back?
And we'd walk back, yeah.
And
yeah.
Train as well?
Yeah. Yeah,
so play a match on train for Belgium. Turned out so well.
Yeah, well, he gave me a huge amount of learnings in life and instilled very, very good values in me. My dad was very traditional in that he worked hard, and the big learning was just be kind. Whether that, not only around finances, but to people. You know, be kind to people, and that certainly was a huge lesson. And obviously the big lesson he gave me right till the end was, no matter what, keep fighting. Yeah. You know, keep fighting till the very end.
What keeps you fighting? And what are you fighting against?
What keeps me fighting is, what am I fighting against? My standards.
Yeah.
My standards of culture. Things that people said I couldn't do. You know, obviously Ballymun was kind of one way or the other, drugs or for me sport. And
was there ever a point where you could have gone drugs and ended up in prison?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Well, considering all my mates are, there's about five of my close friends are in prison now, like, you know.
Do you visit them?
Well, I work in Mountjoy Tuesdays and Thursdays, so I do a programme called, I don't know if you can say this, you probably censor it, but it's called the Unfucked Movement.
Yeah.
And essentially what we're trying to do is we're trying to change the self-belief of the individual and ultimately shine a light on the good culture that's in the prison, so that when they reintegrate into society that their external environment changes and they go a better route in life.
Yeah. How does that happen?
So every Tuesday and Thursday we'd go in and we do fitness classes, we do talks, we kind of develop activities that's going to stimulate the kind of thoughts around things that might push them in a certain direction in life. Like, for example, we do ice baths every so often, and that's to stimulate when they have confrontation. So a lot of these guys would have had low self-image and low self-confidence, so they would have had to eventually commit crime to feed that. So I'll give you an example. There's a guy, and his father would be in class as a hard man, so he had to live up to his father's expectations, and he took drugs for that. And one day he woke up in a cell in a Garda station, and he said to the guard, "What am I doing here?" And the guard said, "You murdered somebody last night." So that stemmed from self-image, you know, that stemmed from the low self-confidence at a very young age and led to him where he is today with his life ruined in prison. So it's kind of looking at them people and trying to understand the person behind the crime.
Yeah.
No difference the way I think we should look at the person behind the addiction.
Was there ever a day when you were 13, 14, when you were, it was a choice if you could have gone that direction and you actually look back on that day?
I've been around drugs a lot.
And did no one ever say, go on, you chicken, or anything like that?
No, there's two reasons why the friends that I grew up never offered me or never, I suppose, egged me on to take drugs or had peer pressure around it. Because one, my brother, right? So the lads would know not to offer me because my brother wouldn't be happy, right?
Yeah.
And then the second thing is that they knew I wouldn't take it. So there was occasions where the guys I would have hung around with would have went off and done robberies and stuff like that. And they'd never invite me.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I wouldn't go. It was like a waste of time.
You were never tempted just to be in with the so-called cool crowd and might jump in the back of a car or something?
Yeah, there was that, you know. I would be lying to say that there was never that, because I tell you why. They used to do this thing where they had a young guy, he was really small, and what they'd do is they'd go into a shopping centre and he'd be able to put his hand under a till and pop the till and they'd be able to take the money, and you'd have three older guys go with him. So if the security guard came in, they'd be able to grab the security guard and they'd escape. And they'd come back, they'd travel all over the country doing that, and they'd come back and there'd be thousands, they'd have thousands in their pockets, like. And there would be that stage where you go, oh, I'd love a few bob like that. And it's no different to today when you have kids being groomed in Ballymun to go and sell drugs or to go and transport drugs. That is happening. Like, that temptation is there. And it's very frightening, because how can you combat, how can we combat, society combat, you know, somebody walking across the road and getting 500-600 euro for like 20-30 minutes. It's very hard to combat. Like,
do you think you can make more of an impact through your charity rather than going into politics?
Yes, I think.
Is that why you haven't considered going into politics?
Yeah, what I'm about now is actually finding. I'll tell you why I'm thinking this way. One day I walked into my house at Sam McGuire, and before I got to the door of the house, actually the kids, all the kids came over and asked for autographs and whatever. And then I was going to do a talk in a youth club, and I came back down the stairs and I was walking back out. One of the younger brothers of the kids I signed their jersey came over to me and said, can I get my jersey on it? I said, yeah, go. He says, are you famous? And I said, before I answered it, I was like, am I actually? I don't know. And he says, oh, you must be, you're on telly. And I said, yeah, I am. And then he said, but you can't be famous, you're from Ballymun.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, jeez, this is what the kids are thinking nowadays, like, you know, that you can't be successful if you're from Ballymun. So I sat down on the path, him, Sam McGuire and me, and I felt great. Just, I don't know what that kid got that day, but I felt amazing. And that was when I realised I had a purpose in life, because I wanted to get as many people on the biggest path as possible. So what's my path now? What's my platform? It's sport.
Yeah.
And I would hope that I can add to that with my charity. That's the next platform. After that, I don't know. You know, obviously sport ends at
my
level.
When does it end for you?
It depends. It depends on players coming through, the manager. Do you stay injury free? Do you perform at the level that you need to perform? There's so many variables.
How will that affect you to suddenly that you're not playing?
Well, look, I'm already building to fill that void through the work I'm doing. So I've been building that for the last, I'd say, nearly 10 years.
Yeah.
You know.
So what about the politics? There was a rumour about you and Sinn Féin.
Yeah, there's a room with me and Sinn Féin and a different party as well. But, like, I'm just happy with the platform I have right now.
Yeah.
You know, I really am. And I think it's, from the charity point of view, it's a preventative tool, and hopefully it impacts people's lives.
Because you're obviously quite passionate about it. It's almost, you remind me a bit of Damien Dempsey, the way you speak. And it's almost bordering on religious, the way you speak. Do you believe in God?
I'm not very religious. I'm very spiritual.
Yeah,
I'm not very religious, and it's just that I don't know what's next. But I am spiritual. I would use the people that have passed in my life as motivation.
Would you like to be a dad yourself one day?
Oh yeah, definitely I would. Yeah. That's something that I suppose
you wouldn't be driving your kid to train.
He'd be walking for an hour
and walking for an hour back.
Yeah. Look, that's obviously a decision that myself and Sarah have to make together. I can't even say it.
Yeah.
It's not mine alone. So yeah, definitely I would.
Yeah. What kind of dad do you think you'd be?
I'd like to be a dad that is supportive, but that allows my kids to make mistakes.
Yeah. What mistake did you make in life?
What mistakes? Oh, I've made loads of mistakes. I think that's why I'm probably successful in certain areas, you know, in my life. Obviously, the mistake of how I get on with my relationships in life, and that's something I'm always striving for. Like, you know, being able to... I got to a stage where I flipped from time management to energy management. So instead of spending 10 hours a week with my family or with my mom or my dad, it got down to, right, I'm going to spend like 2 hours really good quality with you. Let's go. No phones. Going to go for a meal. Let's do this. Like, and I'm constantly striving to be better at that. Sport.
Did your brother's death bring you to that place though?
Did it possibly? Yeah, yeah. But my education is what kind of, I was kind of like, well, if I'm spending 30 odd hours a week playing football and training and 40 hours a week in work, I'm kind of struggling for time there, probably 6 hours a day.
And do you Skype Sarah to stay in touch?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I'm lucky Sarah has a very busy job as well. So kind of works for us.
Brilliant. Okay, Philip McMahon, yeah. Merry Christmas and thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks very much, Barry.